You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Joining me for Throwback Tuesday, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. We've got a jam-packed episode coming your way as we start to head towards Wild Card Weekend. Got some big injury news that was a bit unexpected for the Seahawks today that we're going to break down. And then we're going to revisit some past games for the Seahawks as the number three seed in the NFC. This is only the third time they've earned the number three seed since realignment happened in the 2002 season. So let's get to it. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. As the Seahawks ramp up preparations for their wild card grudge match with the Rams on Saturday, the team revealed some unexpected pass rushing reinforcements may be on the way. Rob, we've talked about this periodically throughout the season, wondering when Daryl Taylor was going to be able to return to the practice field. And at the end of Pete Carroll's Tuesday press conference, he ended up calling out Joe Fan, who Joe has been the one that's asked about Daryl Taylor almost the entire season. So there's a running joke running with at this point. But he asked him, are you going to ask the question? So Joe Fan asked him, is Daryl Taylor going to be practicing? And Carroll responded, he is going to practice today. And it turns out that's exactly what happened. He was not pulling his leg, and Daryl Taylor finally made his practice debut for the Seahawks on Tuesday in the playoffs. And at least for the time being, it has opened the door that if the Seahawks advance past this weekend, we still might see Daryl Taylor play in a game and make his debut during his rookie season.
Yeah, that would be an exciting addition for the Seahawks. I mean, obviously, their pass rush has really returned with a vengeance ever since the club acquired Carlos Dunlap, got Benson Mayoya back and playing well. So the Seahawks have been playing very well in terms of their pass rush. But still, if you can bring a player that has the burst and has the bend around the edge that Daryl Taylor has, then that would be a huge addition to the club, especially considering the fact that the Rams also are having some injured players back, including their Pro Bowl left tackle, Andrew Whitworth, who is practicing this week as well.
Yeah, that's the big point here. And I would be really surprised if we see Daryl Taylor out of the field this weekend. I don't think the Seahawks will be activating him for a playoff game after just three practices. I think even next week is probably pushing it in the divisional round, but we have seen the Seahawks do things in unconventional ways over the years and bring players back. If he looks good in the practice field for a couple of weeks, it certainly could happen. But what a journey that it has been for Daryl Taylor to get to this point. He had surgery to repair a fractured shin, a stress fracture, back in January of 2020. The Seahawks actually got to have a visit with him right before the COVID-19 pandemic brought in a bunch of restrictions and teams could no longer visit in person with prospects. The Seahawks actually got to see where his leg was at, and they must have liked what they saw because they traded up in the second round in April's draft to be able to pick him, and the thought was he would be available at some point during the regular season. Well, every timetable that Pete Carroll came out with, the ever so optimistic Pete Carroll, they weren't able to accomplish it. And by the time we got to the end of this regular season, the last update we had from Carroll was that he was sore after a workout, and it just didn't look good that they were going to see him. At this point, just shut him down, and yet here we are in the playoffs, and now Daryl Taylor maybe has a chance to play. Again, I would be really surprised if he ends up playing in the postseason no matter what. I think they're really happy to get him on the practice field. It provides some momentum for him going towards the 2021 season, but this has been a crazy year, and this is a phenomenal athlete in Daryl Taylor that you would certainly love to add to your pass rush if he's looking good in the practice field. And so who knows? It certainly has opened the door, at least, that we could see him play if the Seahawks can advance past this weekend. I actually put a quick poll up for this before the show, Rob. If the Seahawks advance past this weekend's wildcard round, if our listeners believe Daryl Taylor will play at some point in the playoffs, 48.9% said yes, 51% said no. So almost a 50-50 split. I'm just really curious to see how this plays out. If the Seahawks indeed can get past the Rams and they're able to advance the divisional round, if Daryl Taylor doesn't have any setbacks, if we could see him out there in the postseason.
Well, I think that's funny that it's basically a 50-50 split. I'm sure the Seahawks are feeling basically the same way at this point. You know, Taylor, as you mentioned, Corbin, Taylor is a fantastic athlete. I mean, this isn't the guy who you have to project his ability to the next level. He was a dominant force in the SEC, despite moving different positions, playing the outside linebacker role in a traditional 3-4 scheme, as well as a 4-3 down defensive end. He was second in sacks and tackles for loss each of the past two seasons. In the SEC, going to, you know, playing in a Tennessee squad that, you know, let's face it, the Tennessee Volunteers have not been the powerhouse that they were in the past with Phil Fulmer winning a national championship. So this is a terrific player. And you mentioned that Pete Carroll had been pretty optimistic throughout the season that maybe Daryl Taylor might be able to come back. And then when it sounded like that the Carroll, the always optimistic Pete Carroll, was about as negative as he ever was a couple of weeks ago, saying he just didn't see that it was going to be very likely that the Taylor was going to be able to come back this year, that it might be good to have him have one more offseason before he returns to the field. And yet Taylor obviously has made some strides. So to me, that is a very good sign. And I just love the fact that you have a young player who is showing some resiliency. He basically had a free pass from his head coach to be able to take off the rest of the year. And there's a lot of players out there that would have taken full advantage of that. To see Taylor basically knuckle down and be able to at least give himself the opportunity, to me, is a very exciting thing about the possibility they might be able to play this week, maybe next week, if the Seahawks are able to get back onto the field. And then certainly moving forward, that this is a guy that not only has the physical traits that you're looking for, the proven physical traits, but also the mental strength that the Seahawks have always prioritized. To me, it's a little bit of the justification of why Seattle did make that bold trade-up to acquire him in the first place.
Yeah, and if they're able to get him back for the postseason at all, and he's able to come in and even give him a few meaningful snaps in a rotational role, then it won't feel like his rookie season was a complete waste. Obviously, he did not play in any regular season games. He hadn't practiced to this point, and so his rookie season has been a complete scratch. They're going to be trying to start over going into 2021, but getting him on the practice field, I think, is a big deal. Again, I would be flat out stunned if the Seahawks activate him after just three practices, given the fact that he's coming off this leg injury and he hadn't been able to practice the entire regular season. I just don't see that happening. Maybe next week, if he really is practicing well and he looks healthy, the Seahawks might pull the trigger. I think the big deal here is, who are you going to remove from the roster if you're going to add him to the 53? Because their defensive line is playing pretty well now. Of course, they could make a move to cut Demontre Moore and they could put Daryl Taylor in there, but Moore's been pretty solid on special teams. And so those are some of the things that they will have to consider. There is certainly some risk to that. But again, this is a phenomenal athlete off the edge. There's a reason they traded up to get him. If he's healthy and he feels he can contribute and help this football team, the Seahawks have been experts in the unconventional over the years. They could certainly roll the dice and say, you know what? He's healthy. This kid can come in. We don't care. He didn't play in the regular season. He can help us. We'll just have to wait and see. That's kind of the name of the game right now with all of Seattle's players that are trying to work their way back from injury. Coming up next in the second quarter, we are heading into the postseason. The Seahawks, the number 3 seed in the NFC, just the third time since realignment in 2002. Seattle's had that seeding. We're going to look back at the previous two times on Throwback Tuesday to see how the Seahawks fared as the number 3 seed in the NFC. Don't go away. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Are you ready for some football? The college football championship game is quickly approaching, and the NFL playoffs are set to kick off next weekend. There is only one place that has you covered and one place we trust: betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code LOCKEDON for your 50% welcome bonus. The Seahawks will look to begin a potential Super Bowl run as they face the Rams at Lumen Field, while Alabama hopes to capture another national title against Ohio State, among a bevy of big matchups coming up this weekend. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code LOCKEDON to receive a 50% welcome bonus with your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Throwback Tuesday edition. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. Betting on the NFL doesn't have to be a guessing game. If you listen to the new Locked On Bets podcast, hosted by your boy Q and handicapping expert Lee Sterling, Get daily picks and quick hitting advice to make the smartest possible wagers. Subscribe to the Locked On Bets podcast brought to you by betonline.ag, wherever you get podcasts. It's Throwback Tuesday, Wild Card Edition. Rob, the Seahawks entering this year's postseason as the NFC's number three seed for the first time since 2016 and just the third time overall. Let's go back in time and look at those previous two times where the Seahawks were the number three seed, had the third best record among division winners in the conference. The first time that it happened was way back in 2007. And this is actually a pretty memorable year for me because the Seahawks were a couple years removed from their Super Bowl 40 loss to the Steelers. And this is a team that was getting older. And a lot of people thought if they're going to get back to the Super Bowl, it's going to be this year. Time is running out. The clock is ticking. And this team got hot towards the end of the season and ended up finishing 10-6 to win the division. And then they beat the Washington, then Redskins, 35-14 in the wild card round, only to get trounced by the Packers by 22 points in the divisional. And both those games have really interesting storylines when you go back and look at the box score and rewatch the games on the TV copy.
Yeah, no, they absolutely were, kind of fascinating seasons in a lot of ways, because as you mentioned, Corbin, I mean, this was kind of a changing of the guard. You know, back in 2007, you know, as you kind of mentioned, I mean, Seattle was coming off of the loss in the Super Bowl to the Pittsburgh Steelers a couple of years ago. So, you know, we're talking about Mike Holmgren as the head coach, Matt Hasselbeck at the quarterback position. This was Sean Alexander's last year in Seattle. And so, you know, again, a changing of the guard. The Seattle's top wide receiver for that season was Bobby Engram with over 1,000 yards receiving. So a very different team than they have now, obviously. As you mentioned, that first matchup against Washington back at Quest Field and going up against the Washington team that was coached by Joe Gibbs. So again, talking about a pretty old game. And, you know, one of the players that we were lucky enough to interview, this year was Leonard Weaver. And he really kicked off this game in Seattle's opening a playoff wild card victory over Washington with a big 17-yard run that was kind of just classic Leonard Weaver to get Seattle out to the big lead. And that's the thing, is they marched out to a 13-zip lead. Washington made things close in the fourth quarter where it really started to get kind of tight. In fact, even taking over the lead early in the fourth quarter, 14-13, before Seattle was able to pull away with a big touchdown pass from Matt Hasselbeck to DJ Hackett, as well as a couple of defensive turnarounds.
Yeah, this was one of those weird games that if you look at the final score, 35-14, you'd think, man, the Seahawks just ran Washington out of their own stadium at Quest Field. And that was not at all what happened in this game. Seattle was in control early. It was a defensive game for the most part, but they were up 13-0 after three quarters. And then Washington scored two touchdowns with Todd Collins at quarterback, the journeyman himself. They scored two quick touchdowns back-to-back. Matt Hasselbeck was picked off in between those two touchdowns, and it set Washington up with great field position. And suddenly a 13-point deficit is now a one-point advantage for Washington. But a few drives later, the Seahawks were able to get back into the end zone, and then you had Marcus Trufant as well as Jordan Babineau, two of Seattle's best secondary players, getting pick sixes late in the fourth quarter. And so suddenly a game that was 20-14 suddenly was 35-14. And the Seahawks looked like they ended up winning this game in a rout. And that was not at all the case. It was just one of those strange games where a bunch of points were scored really late in the contest to make it look far more lopsided than it really was. And then that leads us into the next game. We know the Seahawks and their struggles going to Lambeau Field. This was another prime example of that. And this was a very strange game, even stranger than the first round, the wild card matchup. The Seahawks scored 14 points inside the first 5 minutes of this game. Running back Ryan Grant fumbled for the Packers after the Seahawks scored in their opening drive, and the Seahawks had really good field position again, went down and scored again. It's 14-0, and suddenly everybody's thinking, oh man, this Seahawks squad, they're thinking a big upset over Brett Favre and the Green Bay Packers. Well, I can tell you after that point, if you weren't watching this game or you don't remember it, you probably don't want to remember what happened from that point on.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like what we talked about in the first game where Seattle was, fortunately won, but a close game early on that turned into a blowout with a couple of defensive scores for the Seahawks. It wasn't defensive scores for the Packers, but it was an offensive onslaught. I mean, it was 14-14 at the end of the first quarter. Sean Alexander, a one-yard rushing touchdown. It was his last in the Seahawk uniform. Bobby Engram with an 11-yard pass from Matt Hasselbeck. And as you mentioned, Corbin, within the first 5 minutes of the game in Seattle, looks like they might have a chance to shock the Packers, in Lambeau. And yet that's when Brett Favre got hot. That's when Ryan Grant got hot. A couple of touchdowns to Greg Jennings, a third touchdown a little bit later on to Brandon Jackson, and Ryan Grant had a couple of scores as well. And so the Seahawks, again, it was tied 14-14 at the end of one. Seattle would only be able to muster two Josh Brown field goals the rest of the way, however, whereas the Packers were able to score 28 points, two touchdowns in the second quarter and one each in the third and fourth quarter, giving them a 14-20 victory. That was every bit the blowout this time that score indicated.
I think you meant to say 42-20. You said 14-20. So, the Seahawks ended up absolutely getting demolished. And I will always call this the snow debacle. And the reason I call it that is there was no snow coming down. The first 5 minutes of the game, the Seahawks were up 14-0. Then the first snowflake came down at Lambeau Field, and suddenly it was almost like Popeye getting his spinach. The Green Bay Packers were like, oh yes, the snow is coming down. And next thing you know, that deficit has been erased and the Seahawks are dealing with an avalanche, and they got outscored 42-6. The rest of that game. And it was just an absolute trouncing. And so the Seahawks were sent home. And as you said, this was really the end of an era. Sean Alexander's last game as a Seahawk. He struggled in this game. He struggled the entire season. He was getting to be an older back. They ended up releasing him. They got rid of a number of different players after that 2007 season that were core pieces in their Super Bowl team and being in the playoffs a bunch of years in a row. And so this really was the end of an era. They struggled for a few seasons before Pete Carroll came to town. This team, this franchise, this really was their last shining moment with Mike Holmgren on the sidelines. And unfortunately, they just weren't good enough. The Packers were the better team, and they took care of business and won by 22 points in that one at Lambeau. And then we got to fast forward all the way to 2016. Now we are well within the Pete Carroll era. That is the last time the Seahawks had the number 3 seed in the NFC. They went 10-5-1 that year. That was actually the season of the infamous 6-6 tie between the Seahawks and Cardinals in overtime. You watched both kickers botch some short field goals late. Like, nobody wanted to win that game. So the Seahawks ended up falling to 10-5-1, but that was good enough for the number 3 seed. And they opened with a home game at CenturyLink Field against the Detroit Lions. And the Lions were shorthanded. Matt Stafford was not healthy. And I remember most about that game. That was one of the last really good games that Thomas Rawls had in a Seahawks uniform during his brief spell where he was the starting running back. He came out with a team record for playoff yards in a single game running the football. And Seattle ended up cruising in that game. And I also remember Paul Richardson's incredible touchdown reception where he and the defender both had a hold of each other's face mask. I think that's why none of the officials blew a flag on it, because both guys were involved. It was face-on-face crime. And Paul Richardson somehow hung onto that football for a touchdown. So that will always be a play I remember from that contest. But the Seahawks won that one fairly handily. The Lions were never really in it with Stafford not being close to 100%. And this one had a very similar ending, though, as far as how the playoffs unfolded for the Seahawks. They went on the road against the number 1 seed, the Falcons, the next week and got trounced.
Yeah, that's exactly. They got trounced. 36-20 was the final score in this game. And then again, it looked like Seattle, they jumped out to the early lead, 7-0, Jimmy Graham touchdown from Russell Wilson. But then Atlanta just absolutely woke up in the second quarter, scored 19 points at that point. Seattle did score every quarter of this game. But again, Atlanta scoring 19 points in the second quarter, a touchdown in the third, a touchdown and a field goal in the fourth to give them a 36-20. 20 victory for a coach or for Dan Quinn's Atlanta Falcons, the team that wound up going to the Super Bowl that year. Seattle, as you mentioned, was 10-5 at the end of the regular season in 2016, the last year that they won the NFC West division, up until now, of course, under Pete Carroll. And then that last season we talked about in 2007 with the Seahawks and Mike Holmgren, they were 10-6 that season as well. So for Seattle to have the number three seed each of these 3 years, this is the year that in 2020 where Seattle has clearly the better record at 12-4 this year. So number three seed all three seasons, but a team that has a much higher record this season. When I look back at that 2016 squad, you know, you mentioned Thomas Rawls, and he was absolutely spectacular in that big win against Detroit. I don't know off the top of my head if that is the record for the club, but 161 rushing yards in that game, a long of 32 yards and a touchdown scored against the Lions. So a spectacular performance. But you look at Seattle's running game as a whole that year, Christian Michael, the great Christian Michael, was Seattle's actually leading rusher that season. And so this, again, even though it was Pete Carroll, even though it was Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, a lot of the big names that you remember of the Seahawks lore, this was a very different team that wasn't built around the running game the way this current version of the Seahawks are.
Yeah, just different squads, different records. And I think that those losses, nobody was really surprised the Seahawks got trounced in either one of those matchups, especially when he didn't have Earl Thomas, who had broken his leg earlier in the season. He was not available in 2016 when they lost the Falcons, and Atlanta took advantage of Stephen Terrell playing free safety. That's as big of a drop off at a position as you're going to have. Prime Earl Thomas going to Stephen Terrell, no offense to him, a solid backup, a solid special teams guy, but Atlanta took advantage of that. And then, as I said earlier, that team from 2007, they were just getting old and they really got off to a fast start. And then from that point, the Packers had younger talent at most positions. Brett Favre was still playing at such a high level. And especially when the snow started coming down, everything was pointing against the Seahawks there. So they just were not able to maintain that momentum. And those two teams were not Super Bowl caliber squads. You know, maybe with a different path, they would have been able to get to the Super Bowl, but they had two really rough road games in the divisional round. The Seahawks this time around, as we mentioned yesterday, they don't have to go to Lambeau until the NFC Championship game. If they can get that far, they would have to play the Saints in New Orleans probably in round two if they advance past the Rams this weekend. But not having many or any fans there is certainly going to hinder the normal home field advantage that the Saints would have at the Superdome. So we'll see how things play out. It's always fun to look back historically how the franchise is done, though, with different seedings. The number three seed, they are 2-2 all time record wise. They've never been able to get past the divisional round. We'll see if they can buck that trend, and third time is a charm. When we come back for the third quarter, we're going to look at some defensive takeaways from Seattle's season finale victory over the 49ers. Another standout performance by many defensive players for the Seahawks going against an undermanned 49ers offense. Don't go away. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Chain stores have different price tiers for professional mechanics and do-it-yourselfers. Why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? RockAuto.com's prices are the same for everybody and are reliably low. RockAuto.com always offers the lowest prices possible rather than changing prices based on what the market will bear like airlines do. They have everything from engine control modules and brake parts to tail lamps, motor oil, and even new carpet. Whether it's for your classic or daily driver, get everything you need in a few easy clicks delivered directly to your door. The RockAuto.com catalog is unique, remarkably easy to navigate, and all the parts are available for your vehicle. Choose the brand, specifications, and prices you prefer. Go to RockAuto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car or truck. Write "Locked in their "How did you hear about us" box so they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. RockAuto.com. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Tuesday edition. This is your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by my co-host in crime, Rob Rang, NFL analyst Brian Peacock, and former NFL scout Matt Williamson host Locked On's Peacock and Williamson every Monday through Friday. Brian and Matt give you the national perspective all around the NFL, covering all the latest news and insight on every game, team, and move around the NFL. Get your picks, previews, and much more every weekday with the Peacock and Williamson podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Seahawks wrapping up their 2020 regular season with their 12th victory. It was in comeback fashion against the 49ers on Sunday, and they held on for a 26-23 win. First 12-win season for the Seahawks since way back in 2014, the last time that the Seahawks played in the Super Bowl. And it was another stellar defensive outing, not the best that the Seahawks have had in the second half of the season. They did give up 23 points, and a lot of that damage came in the fourth quarter. Defense wasn't playing quite as well, had a few injuries. Jamal Adams and Jaron Reed were out of the lineup for large chunks of the second half, but still, they were able to hold their opposition to just 23 points. The last touchdown, those were garbage points going against a prevent defense, and there was a lot of positives still to glean from this game, Rob.
Oh, absolutely there were. I mean, we talked about it heading into this game, Corbin, that you had, if Seattle was going to be successful against San Francisco, their primary goal was to be able to slow down San Francisco's rushing attack. And, you know, because Kyle Shanahan, I think that you said that he could find somebody who was driving an ice cream truck and still be able to run for 100 yards. And that's basically what happened, is because Jeff Wilson Jr. is a terrific talent. And we saw flashes of that. But at the same time, to me, one of the most impressive things in this game was the fact that San Francisco does have a terrific rushing attack. And yet, of the 17 first downs that San Francisco received, only two of them were through the ground. And so really, Seattle was able to make San Francisco basically attack this game with one hand tied behind their back. And anytime you have a team that is one-dimensional, they're that much easier to beat. And so obviously, Seattle or San Francisco was able to make that push in the fourth quarter, make things a little bit interesting. But I think that Seattle basically felt from the get-go that they had this game in hand, that they could control. And it was only after the 49ers showed a little bit of life, after Seattle's offense didn't show much of their own, that's when Seattle had to get a little bit more aggressive and pull out the victory at the very end.
And as they've done all season, this defense, even when they were struggling the first half of the year, how many times did this defense come up with clutch stops or clutch turnovers that they generated when they absolutely needed them? We saw the defense do that again, and it revolves around the two players that I thought had the strongest games on Sunday. And we've been talking for weeks about how this defensive line as a whole, everyone has elevated their games since the arrival of Carlos Dunlap. And that's the big reason the Seahawks have produced 34 sacks in their last nine games, the most in the NFL during that span. Some of it's been Jamal Adams. Obviously, he's factored into that as well. But this defensive line has been able to ratchet up pressure on quarterbacks, and they were able to do that the other day on C.J. Beathard, especially late. We saw Benson Mayoa, again, another fantastic game for him. Two sacks in this contest. The second one, he really looked – I had to do a double take and make sure that Cliff Avril hadn't snuck into a uniform and returned to the field, because it looked like a carbon copy of what Cliff Avril used to do rushing off the edge for the Seahawks. A speed rush, turning the corner, showing great bend, and then tomahawk chopping down on Beathard's arm to force the football out before he started moving forward with his motion. Fumble, Rasheem Green covers it. And by the way, Rasheem Green had a sack that ended up thwarting a drive and forcing the 49ers to kick a field goal earlier in the game. So I thought both of those guys played outstanding in all four quarters. Green had a couple big run stops. Mayoa had a run stop. He had four more pressures to go along with his sacks. And so you add in the fact he had six pressures the week before against the Rams. He's playing as good a football as he has at any point in his career. Rasheem Green's come on here the last few games. We're finally seeing what we thought we were going to see going into his third season. We're starting to see him blossom. And so I thought those two guys had fantastic games against the 49ers.
No, I absolutely agree. They really did. And that's one of the most exciting things about it, is these are still, you know, relatively young players. I mean, Mayoa, of course, has been playing for a while, but at the same time, he certainly looked fresh against the 49ers. And that's one of the things that you're excited about, because obviously, if you are fortunate enough to get further into the playoffs and you are going to be going up against some of the elite quarterbacks, elite passing offenses in all of the NFL. And so you need Mayoa to be able to come back and play at that role. And that's exactly what he looked like. But as I mentioned before, you know, to me, one of the things that really jumps out is the fact that Seattle was able to slow down San Francisco's running game as much as they were. And if they're going to be able to do that, then the linebackers had to play at an extremely high level, and they were able to do exactly that. You know, I've been one of those who's been kind of knocking Bobby Wagner's play, and it wasn't the flashiest of games that I've ever seen from him. But number 54 was laying some hits, and speaking of big hits, oh my goodness, KJ Wright was spectacular. And then George Brooks wound up leading the team in tackles. And I know people are going to criticize him because he gave up some of the receptions to Jeff Wilson for the touchdown, gave up some receptions to George Kittle. But at the same time, again, you kind of have to acknowledge every now and then when the opponents have a really good player, and George Kittle is exactly that.
Yeah, I thought Jordan Brooks still had a pretty good game. He did give up six receptions and a touchdown in coverage. He gave up that garbage touchdown, which honestly, I don't think he was in bad position necessarily. He just kind of broke on the football a little late, and he's going to improve there. And when he does, that might turn into a pick six with the speed that he has. And so there were some positives even from that play that I could glean. But KJ Wright, that hit that he made on Kyle Juszczyk, and he's talked to reporters about this a couple times today. He gave the story again, but he was joking around. Obviously, he and Juszczyk are pretty close. They talk regularly, but he gets tired of Kyle Juszczyk constantly cut blocking him, even when the play is away from KJ Wright. And so for him, this was a little bit of redemption, the chance I can dish out a hard hit that's still clean. And he did exactly that, just absolutely obliterating Juszczyk. And honestly, Bobby Wagner was the one that got most excited there. He came flying in and was celebrating that big hit on Juszczyk. Juszczyk got up and had some choice words and was kind of laughing a little bit. So you could tell there's not bad blood necessarily, but they're rivals. They played against each other a lot. So that was a big hit. And then he also had that 5 yards tackle for loss against George Kittle on a swing route that he just came flying out of his linebacker stance. And he looked faster than he is just because of his instincts. He plays fast. He reacts fast. And so he was able to do that again. Swing routes, screens, those type of plays, KJ Wright is the king at stopping those. And we saw it once again. So he and Wagner, all three of the linebackers, played really well in this game. And the other guy I want to outline, we're talking positives. He didn't play any defensive snaps, but he's making tackles on special teams pretty much every time the Seahawks are kicking off or punting. And that's Cody Barton. Nick Ballores continued to have a great season. He had two more special teams tackles in this game. But Cody Barton, it has just felt like over the last couple of months that it's pretty much every tackle you see the tackler get up and it's number 57. And as he continues to do that, to me, there is still a potential future for him on this defense, as well as KJ Wright and Bobby Wagner playing. There may still be a future for him 2021 and beyond, where with his speed, his tackling ability, his aggressiveness, it seems like he's more aggressive this year than he was his rookie season, that he's going to find ways to get on the field, and he's taking advantage of his special teams opportunities. If Nick Ballore is your Pro Bowler, then I think Cody Barton is kind of 1B to 1A, as good as he's been this year.
No, it's a really good point. I think that, you know, Nick Ballore, of course, got the Pro Bowl nod, but I would argue that Cody Barton has been every bit as good. And again, as good as Barton was, as flashy plays as he made against the 49ers, give Ballore some credit too, because not only did he have a couple of tackles, he also caught the onside kick, which is obviously critical in that game as well. But I like that you mentioned like kind of 1A, 1B. You know, when you watch these games and you hear, you know, the television announcers who don't really know the Seahawks very well, they just know some of the big names, and how much credit that Bobby Wagner gets and KJ Wright doesn't necessarily get as much attention. And yet I thought that he had the more impactful game against the 49ers, how much attention that Jamal Adams gets. And yet if we're going to talk about big hits, then the just absolutely monstrous hits that Quandre Diggs has been supplying over these last couple of weeks is really, you know, generate a great deal of excitement for the Seahawks as well. So, yeah, I love that you mentioned Barton and how that he is kind of teaming up with Nick Ballore to give Seattle two very, very impactful special teams players. And the same thing at the linebacker and safety positions. The guys that are getting all the pub aren't necessarily the guys that are putting offensive players into the ground.
Yeah, these guys are just making fantastic plays. And Quandre Diggs gave up one reception downfield that was really more a remarkable catch by Kittle than anything else, but he still had another really good game. To me, if you're going to look at negatives, obviously, I saw this in the second half in particular, and we actually, in the first half, there were a couple coverage busts that C.J. Beathard just simply did not take advantage of, and the announcers talked about it. The one that stands out to me, they ended up scoring points on this drive, but he had George Kittle wide open in the end zone. It was a clear busted coverage. If George Kittle's wide open like that, somebody totally messed up their assignment. And there were a few other examples that the 49ers were able to take advantage of. We saw Shaquille Griffin get beat downfield on a deep ball to Richie James in the first half. So there were some coverage busts in this game. There were some plays that the 49ers just didn't take with their third string quarterback in that against a better quarterback, the Seahawks could have been burned on. There was another touchdown. I think it was Ross Dwelly, their backup tight end, was wide open and Beathard missed him there too. And so there were some coverage busts in this game. That is something going back in the film, you must clean up before you play the Rams. I don't care who's playing quarterback. Sean McVay is going to scheme to take advantage of coverage busts if you don't correct those issues. So that and a few missed tackles, those are the things that kind of I'm a little bit concerned about coming out of this game. But I expect Ken Norton Jr. and Pete Carroll and those guys to get on their players. They're going to be accountable for their own play, and I expect them to clean that up.
Oh, I do as well. That absolutely. I mean, anytime you I think it's fair to criticize the tackling. If you miss some tackles, if you have some coverage busts, that's going to happen. I think especially against a team that likes to run the ball and has the backup or third string quarterback like the 49ers do, then you know that the cornerbacks at times are going to be looking into the backfield because they're going to be expecting run. And so you can expect that there's going to be some times where they get beat, the safeties get beat. But as I said before, I think you have to just kind of tip your cap sometimes to George Kittle because he is just such a freakish athlete. But I was surprised that Kendrick Bourne, as much as I love the Eastern Washington Eagles, I was surprised that Kendrick Bourne was able to have as big of a game as he had. He wound up with 5 receptions, Corbin, for 76 yards. All 5 of his catches resulted in first downs. That knowing that you're going up against a Rams team that has some of the playmakers that they have at the wide receiver position, that does have to get cleared up. Otherwise, the Seahawks are in real trouble.
Yeah, I thought that we saw some struggles. Again, Griffin giving up that deep ball. I thought Ugo Amadi had a pretty rough game in this one. He allowed several receptions. It was definitely not his finest game of the season. So he's going to have to pick up his play. And you know the Rams are going to be looking at that film, and they're going to be trying to take advantage of some of the stuff the 49ers did capitalize and some of the things that they didn't capitalize on that they should have, because he's a really good offensive coach. And so, again, you got to clean this stuff up. But it's a little different than the offense. This defense has been playing so well over the last 7-8 games that you got to be confident the coaching staff and the players are going to get those things corrected before they go into the biggest game of the season in the wild card round. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at CorbinSmithNFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is, by going to our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's Matchup Wednesday. Feels like we've talked about some of these matchups recently, but there's going to be a little bit of a different twist here with some of the players coming back from injury and the quarterback uncertainty for the Rams. So we'll be looking at offensive and defensive matchups to watch when the Seahawks host the Rams in a grudge match in the wild card round. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday, and thanks for listening. Go Hawks.